but it goes without saying.
I'm terribly pleased and proud to be here, and as Dr. McCauley has just said, the pleasure is all the nicer to be to have this lecture associated with my former colleague, Dr. Lorand, and he did such wonderful work at the lab at Leeds that it broke my heart. He said he wanted to go to America. That doesn't mean to say I don't think any the less of America. It means I thought more of Dr. Lorand, that's all. Now, this lecture is going to be over a very large range, and I hope will interest a great many of you from all sorts of aspects. And the scope is, say, from the largest animals, like the whales, and their muscles, and the skin, and their internal moustache that is called whalebone, down through ordinary-sized muscles and hairs, and lower still to the flagella of algae, and down to the flagella of bacteria. And I want to show you that is all one story, and this is really a study extending over 20 or 25 years, the molecular basis of biological motility. And though I say I'm ranging from the largest animals to the smallest possible organ of propulsion, I want to show you that the nature's dodge, nature's trick, is the same throughout this enormous field. Now, I want to just show a few slides passing down, stepping down to the finest level or to the lowest level at which I want to discuss things, that is that of bacterial flagella. Now, of course, theoretically, I should start by showing you a slide of a whale, but I thought perhaps you'd seen, you knew what a whale looked like. So I'll start off by showing first a photomicrograph, that is what can be seen under the ordinary microscope of an alga with a flagellum, a tail. We shall drop this word flagella and use the word tails, which is much more homely. I mean homely in the English sense, of course. Tails can be homely or not homely in the American sense. But I mean in the English sense, in the English sense it's more homely. In our lab we call them tails, though it doesn't mean to say we know no Latin. Of course we are very fine people in our lab, and we do know that flagellum is the Latin for a whip, and the plural is flagella. There are various misguided people in this world, not in this audience of course, who think the plural is flagelli, but it isn't so. It's flagella. Well, first of all, let's look at a slide with a single tail. This is the alga Euglena. You probably have seen pictures of it. And this is a photomicrograph. The light's off, please. And there is the scale, 50 microns. And it knocks about at great speed, as you know, by waggling that tail. And it is the mechanism of such tails on the molecular level that we're going to discuss. Now, we can look at the same animal, this protozoan, in the electron microscope, and the body now, of course, occupies the body is very large, and the tail is coming out there, and there's a scale now, that is 1 micron, but what I want you to notice, if you can see at the back, is a little curly thing here, which is a little piece of a bacterial flagellum, and it is later on in this lecture that we're going to talk specially of the molecular structure. In fact, they are single molecules themselves, of these flagella and how they work, and to relate them to ordinary physiological muscles with which you're more familiar. Now, notice that then the scale. We've jumped down from the optical microscope, and there's the tail we were looking at on the level of the electron microscope. Then, by comparison, there is this bacterial flagella, a little piece of it. Now, let's have the next picture, please. You see, this is a typical flagellate bacterium, and you might think it's an ordinary one. It has a lot of tails here, but I'd like to point out that it isn't an ordinary one at all. It is one from the teeth of one of the chaps in my lab, and which makes it rather extraordinary, and we thought it'd be very nice for the purpose of lectures to keep this. And but I say, we don't know what species it is, except it comes from the teeth of one of the people in my lab. But this is the sort of thing, again, that we're going to study, this waviness, because this waviness is an expression of a transmission of a wave motion by which these animals are propelled. I should stop to perhaps qualify that, because though it is seems pretty obvious that bacteria swim by means of these flagella, they don't all really swim, and it's hard to prove that it is the actual organ of propulsion. I think the evidence is becoming more and more overwhelming that most bacteria and algae do swim by wave motions, rhythmic movements of these flagella, but there are some flagella which twist themselves about and swim by means of a kind of a belly dance, and this method of swimming by means of flagella is not the only method. And it is really a question of logic. I say that it is pretty certain now that this is the method of propulsion, but you must remember, of course, that if a man, say, is swimming and smoking, puffing away a cigarette as he is swimming, it does not follow logically that he is swimming by means of jet propulsion. We must be quite sure of the logic of the argument. However, from our point of view today, it doesn't really matter whether they are swimming with these tails, because we are studying the nature of biological movement. There's no doubt that these tails move, and they move in very beautiful rhythmic gyrations and that sort of thing. Well, I want to go back now to the background. I told you the story really starts from hairs and muscles, with which we have been occupied for over 20 years, and the beginning of the story really dates from our early X-ray work on the structure of wool and hair, which, as you know, is made of the protein keratin. And the fundamental observation was to show by X-rays that ordinary wool or hair, it doesn't matter what we call it, gives one kind of diffraction pattern, and when we stretch the hair, then we get another X-ray diffraction pattern. And it is the stretch form of hair which corresponds to the extended state of polypeptide chains. That is almost a childish deduction, you might think, but it was very, very fundamental in those days. That is, we showed that the normal form of hair, or the protein keratin in hair, in any mammalian hair, was not extended polypeptide chains, but a regularly folded or twisted system in some sort of way. In any case, it wasn't pulled out straight. And in fact, when you stretched a hair, you pulled out the polypeptide chains to something like double their normal length. The normal state, this regularly folded state, we called alpha. Now, everyone all over the world knows what you mean by the alpha keratin configuration, because it is one of the great subjects that are being discussed more and more intensively, and in more and more papers. You've only got to open Nature or the National Academy of Sciences, reading the Royal Society, anything else, you see discussions on the configurations of polypeptide chains round what is the nature of the alpha form of keratin and myosin. And in the course of years, this primary study on wool spread out to cover nominally half the protein fibers in the world. Very soon we showed that this particular molecular configuration that we discovered in alpha keratin was also the configuration of myosin in ordinary relaxed muscle. And also later we showed, other people showed, that it was the configuration of the epidermin, the fibrous protein of the epidermis. And later of fibrinogen and fibrin and paramyosin and tropomyosin and a whole lot of apparently unrelated things, culminating most recently in the protein of bacterial flagella. Now all these belong to the same family. They all have this folded configuration in their normal state. They're all susceptible of long-range elasticity. They can be stretched into the extended beta form, and they give two photographs of the alpha or beta type, and these are all almost indistinguishable, as I shall show you in the next slide, please. Here are some of the members of what we used to call the keratin myosin group. We call the KMEF group, keratin, myosin, epidermin, fibrinogen. But there are other members which have been discovered since, and so we decide to stop there and not put any more on. The KM sometimes is called the keratin myosin group. But here are some of the original members that we observed. Is that in focus? See, there's the original one, alpha keratin of mammalian hair. That is the normal folded configuration. That is what the classical alpha diagram. Then when it is stretched, it gives this classical beta diagram. And you see the same repeated with myosin alpha-myosin and beta-myosin, epidermis, muscle itself, fibrinogen and fibrin, and then I say a lot of others which we are not included. This is an old slide. Now this is one of the great master plans of nature. It is the basis of long-range elasticity and motility in not only in hairs but particularly in muscles, and I want to show you also in the movement of these simplest and smallest of all propulsive organs, the flagella of bacteria, an algae. Now let me just give you a list, bringing this classification up to date, and perhaps I should say that we're dealing now with nominally half all the protein fibers in life, the other half belonging to another master family called the collagen group, which covers connective tissue, tendons, sarcolemma, jellyfish, skins of worms, and all sorts of things of that kind, and they, in their way, are just important as this group, but we're not going to talk about those, or don't need to talk about them today. But the other half of all the protein fibers fall under another great master plan called that of the collagen group. However, the next slide, please. Here is a list, up to date, of the keratin myosin group. And I suppose you can read it from there, but alpha keratin, myosin, and the sources of them. And here is the subgroup belonging to feathers and scales of lizards and the beaks of birds, which I won't discuss. That is a subgroup of that. Now, that is the sort of thing we're discussing. And the latest one, which is called flagellin, from bacterial flagella, is also perhaps the most outstanding member of the whole family. And this table here indicates the range of the topics which we're going to talk about today. But I want to say, and I keep on saying, that it is only one topic. This is the structure of a master plan in nature, which is used as a basis of motility, down from the largest muscles to the smallest organs of propulsion on bacteria. Now let me summarize it again, that configurationally. The next one, please. You see, that is the way you'd see a polypeptide chain written out in a book, conventionally, and we can represent that fully extended chain by just a line drawn out straight. And that is extended configuration. We call that the beta configuration, because the normal one is usually folded. And this will represent diagrammatically, not necessarily with any no atomic detail, the structure of normal keratin of hair, or myosin of muscle, or fibrinogen, or epidermin, and that sort of thing. And this is the direction of the fiber axis. And when we pull the hair, these folds pull out and we get an extended chain, which when we let go, they fold up again to give this alpha form. Now I say that is also that is also a relaxed form of muscle, and when we stretch myosin, and in fact muscle in certain conditions, we can get muscle also in the beta form. Now, you'd say, of course, where does the contraction of muscle come into this story? And that is actually a key question, because we also were able to show that all the members of this family, this keratin, myosin, epidermin, fibrinogen group, they were not susceptible not only of being stretched from the alpha to the beta form, thereby giving the ordinary long-range elasticity which you observe when you stretch a hair, but they were all capable of being contracted to a length shorter than their normal length. And that state we called the supercontracted state. Now I want to make this point very clear, because to understand how the bacterial flagella work, I want you to grasp this point, not in detail, but in principle, the principle of supercontraction. Could I have the light, please? The normal form, then, of this great elastic family is this normal folded form, alpha, and it can be stretched out into about twice the ordinary length and beta, and that gives the ordinary elasticity of hair and certain phases in the stretching of muscle. But over the passage of years, we've been able to show that this isn't the whole story at all, but the alpha form can be contracted into what we call a supercontracted form. That is to distinguish it from this ordinary folded form, which is 30 or 50% shorter than the normal alpha form. Now, This, in our view, is formally the basis of the contraction of muscle. The contraction of muscle is brought about by some change of configuration from the normal form of myosin, or more strictly actomyosin, to some shorter form. And in our view, this is only a special manifestation of a property which is common to all the members of the keratin myosin group. They are all susceptible of contracting in a similar way to a length shorter than their normal into this supercontracted state, as we call it. Now, say, in our view, this property, which is common to the whole group, has been specialized and brought to its highest perfection in the cycle of muscular contraction. The muscle contraction then is from that state to that one, to a shorter state. Now, I want to show you, for the purposes of identification chiefly, what is the X-ray result of supercontracting, say, in the laboratory, fibers of hair or epidermis or myosin. You have a certain striking diffraction effect, which I don't want you to struggle to understand, but I want you to observe it as an experimental fact, because this is what is observed in the X-ray photographs of bacterial flagella. Now, could I have the next slide, please? When we stretch a hair, we get this classical normal beta pattern, this diffraction pattern, which is dominated by two strong reflections on the equator, whose spacing is 4.65 angstrom units, and which is a measure of one of the side linkages of these chains when they're pulled out straight. In fact, it is a measure of the hydrogen bond between CO and NH. It is the effective length of the hydrogen bond, which links side by side the protein chains in one direction. Now, in the supercontracted state, these are two pictures prepared by my colleague Dr. Rudol of an oriented strip of epidermin, a protein prepared from the epidermis, and this is the epidermin stretched in the normal beta form by just pulling it out, and here is what he finds when the epidermis is supercontracted by heat. And this dramatic transformation, that this reflection which you get on the equator now appears suddenly on the meridian. It is spread out here because the effect is imperfect. And as you remember from the drawing I just put on the board, our conception, diagrammatically, of supercontraction, this state shorter than the normal state, is that of long transverse folds transverse to the fiber axis, which is always in this direction here. And you should expect this length of the hydrogen bond, the CO and H linkage, now is thrown on, the reflection is thrown onto the meridian. Now, that is probably too complicated to take in all at once. What I wanted you to realize, just to remember till I come to the flagella, is that the only X-ray indication we have so far, and it is in vitro indication, because all these experiments are done on isolated fibers made from the keratin myosin group. This in vitro manifestation of supercontraction by X-rays is always refined in intense forms of supercontraction, is this reflection on the meridian of spacing 4.65, what is known as the famous backbone reflection, which is a measure of the CONH hydrogen bond distance. I want you then, never mind whether this interpretation is right or not, it's beside the point. It is an experimental fact that in intensely supercontracted epidermis, say, you find this reflection on the meridian, and it is an outward and visible X-ray sign that supercontraction has taken place, without quite apart from whether this interpretation is correct. It is an experimental fact. Now, we can pass very rapidly over the muscle situation by simply the use of one electron micrograph. The next, please. This is one of the loveliest electron micrographs I know of a myofibril. It is obtained by two Australians, Draper and Hodge. And it is a delightful study. There are all the usual bands there for which you're familiar from ordinary histology. the A and the I band and the Z band and the M band, all those things. But what I'm going to use this partly as just simply a stepping stone to pass straight over from the general talk about the keratin-myosin group to the problem of bacterial flagella. Because if I made myself clear, basically the problem of muscle is the problem of a change of configuration of myosin, or more strictly, actomyosin filaments. And all the rest is the apparatus made all the apparatus required to bring this cycle of changes about. And really, the muscle boils down to these long, fine filaments, which probably go through the whole of the sarcomere, and maybe of the order of 100 or only 50 angstrom units thick. But all the way through, you see what is the essential muscle mechanism is these fine filaments which get shorter and come back again, and all the rest are the fuel devices and the trigger devices to make this thing work. Now, I say we can pass then straight through this stage of muscle. We can summarize and dismiss muscle in almost a sentence and say it is the problem of the contractility of these fine filaments. And you'll notice in this very beautiful electron micrograph there is a fine cross striation besides the main ones with which you're familiar. All the way through there is a cross striation of the order of 400 angstrom units. I want you to remember that. That is the macro period along the threads of muscle corresponding exactly to what is found also by X-rays. In X-ray diffraction photographs of skeletal muscle, you find there is a long period along the fiber axis, which is about 410 angstrom units. And this can also be seen in these electron micrographs, which, by the way, are stained with phosphotungstic acid. Well then, so the muscle then is really a long thread in its simplest form, which gets shorter or longer, and in our view gets shorter when it passes from the alpha form to the supercontracted form. And along it there is this long period of 400, which can be shown even more beautifully by X-rays and measured much more accurately. Now that will help us then to come down to the problem of bacterial flagella, because you see when we start talking about filaments about 100 angstrom units thick, even though we can see them here now in the electron microscope, we are now down at the level of macromolecules. Molecules like myosin are of the order of 100 or more angstrom units thick. And I say we are actually looking at a molecular manifestation of the muscle apparatus, and it brings us down to the level of bacterial flagella, which I shall demonstrate to you are actually single molecules and single, actually monomolecular muscles. Now, could I have the light, please? Now, let's talk a bit about the history of this work on bacterial flagella. What I've been reviewing so far is work which has been going on since about before 1930, and you'll understand quite readily that in working with hair and muscle and all these wonderful members of the keratin-myosin group, and in showing that they all belong to one great family and were subject to one master plan, the unity of this concept, of course, is enormous to classify the whole of protein fibers into two master plans: the elastic plan we're talking about now and the collagen plan, which is involved in the tendons and rheumatic disease and all that sort of thing. Well, you couldn't, I say it's impossible to think and work with these things without a longing to have a go at bacterial flagella. And that seemed quite impossible because they are obviously below the limit of resolution. What are called flagella in the ordinary microscope are not really flagella at all. They are groups of these flagella or tails beating in unison. They are tails of groups of flagella. The flagella themselves cannot be seen in an ordinary microscope, because I showed you in the lecture at the beginning, they are down at the level of 100 or 200 angstrom units, which is far below the level of the electron microscope. Well, I say I never hoped that we should ever be able to take X-ray photographs and study these bacterial flagella till after the war, the news came through that Sven Gard, a city bacteriologist in Stockholm, had succeeded in preparing bacterial flagella in considerable quantities, pure preparations, considerable quantities that you could use for experimental purposes. And like all great experiments in science, this turned out to be intensely simple. He just simply had a bottle of the bacteria with their tails and shook them until their tails fell off. Now, that is a very great experiment. It's not, I've not described it really strictly scientifically. What happened, of course, was that the heads fell off the tails, because that's part of the experiment. And so when the heads fell off the tails, he could centrifuge the heads by means of an ordinary centrifuge, leaving the tails in the supernatant floating about as and behaving exactly as macromolecules. This experiment then is to shake these creatures till the heads fall off. Then we have a bottle of tails, which is a solution of tails, because the tails themselves are only macromolecules. And they can be studied and operated upon by the ultracentrifuge, by electrophoresis, and all the other things. And in fact, you can precipitate these tails with ammonium sulfate, which I always thought a very sweet thought, that you can precipitate tails by half-saturated ammonium sulfate. But you can, which shows that though they are tails, they're also macromolecules. Now, this thing was so exciting that the Swedish National Research Council decided to take up the thing in rather a big way, because Sven Gard was a city bacteriologist, and they handed it over to Tiselius to get down to the job with all the resources of physics and chemistry, and he had an assistant, Dr. Weibel. And I got to know this, and I went to see Tiselius, and they'd already made great advances. In fact, Weibel had made much more extensive and pure preparations than Sven Gard, and had got a long way with the analysis. It wasn't a nucleoprotein, it was an ordinary straightforward protein containing very little phosphorus, or practically no phosphorus or carbohydrate, and it formed very beautiful solutions which you could concentrate, and when they were concentrated they showed very striking flow birefringence, and you could centrifuge them, you could electrophorese them, and all these things. And in the electron microscope they looked exactly like they did on the bodies of the animals, except they were rather shorter because in the centrifugation and other things they got broken. But essentially they can be isolated and purified and behave just like a solution of gelatin or myosin or sodium thiamonucleate, and they simply were howling out or crying out for examination by x-rays, and I arranged with Tiselius for Weibel to bring these preparations of relatively harmless bugs, Proteus vulgaris and B. subtilis, because Sven Gard had been working with the Salmonella group, which was too dangerous, of course. But Weibel, I say, made beautiful preparations of Proteus and B. subtilis and brought them over to Leeds, and then we made films. I needn't go into the technique, but we had all the technique developed already, as we had used for myosin and other members of the keratin myosin group. And in a few days, this dream suddenly came true. It is striking that in a matter of 3 days, with the help of my colleague, Dr. Baton, who has worked with me continuously in the X-ray side of this and whose photographs you will see, Dr. Baton was able to get a photograph which showed that indeed this bacterial flagella did belong to the same family as hair and muscle. And we could say at once that the photograph was an alpha diagram, a diffraction diagram of the alpha type with which we had been familiar for 20 years. And we could say straight away, unequivocally, that bacterial flagella are essentially monomolecular hairs or muscles. It didn't really matter whether we call them hairs or muscles, because if you follow my argument, hairs and muscles belong to the same master plan, and they are only variations on the same theme. And I think I ought to show you some pictures now. See, this is a photograph of the kind of which you must be very familiar. This is the Proteus vulgaris in its multi-flagellate form, when it has so many tails that it can't swim at all. It's a sort of seized up state. And when it is younger and fresher, it has only a few tails and can get a move on. But I always put this on because there's such a lot of tails here to show, and it's rather nice. Now, in Leeds, I say, Dr. Baton obtained, and Dr. Weibel too, obtained quite a lot of X-ray photographs of films made simply by drying down a sol. You've got a solution, a stiff solution, a thick solution of these tails, and you could dry down this sol to form very thin films, which you can study by X-rays. And quite a lot of photographs, as you'll understand, have been obtained. And we've recently put them together in a composite photograph like the next, please. You see, it is a fearful and wonderful pattern. It is very much better than you get from wool, and probably better than some photographs you get even from muslin. This is a composite diagram made from all the photographs we've obtained, and the fibre direction is always, in these things, is always vertical, this way. But what I want to point out in this picture, this is essentially an alpha diagram, such as you can get from skeletal muscle, or wool, or porcupine quill. And it is dominated by this classical arc, whose spacing is 5.1. It's known all over the world as the alpha arc here. But also, in every photograph we obtain also this other arc, which is the backbone reflection, to which I drew your attention when I was talking about supercontracted epidermis, or any supercontracted form of this family. That reflection there is a backbone reflection of 4.65. And we always find them. It's impossible, we found it impossible to take a photograph of bacterial flagella without finding not only the alpha arc there, but the beta arc there too. Now, together with that, now, don't think what I'm going to say is childish. Many of the most important observations seem to be childish. But whenever you look at bacterial flagella in the electron microscope, you always find them wavy. They don't straighten out. You can straighten them out, but you do have to use chemical means. They're always wavy, and when they are shaken off the bodies, they drop off and they die instantaneously in this wavy form. For this, I've coined a phrase, I've called it molecular rigor mortis. It's terribly important for us that just at the moment of transmitting their rhythmic movements, as we shall see later, or spiral movements, they're shaken off the body of the animal and they die like that, are frozen in that state, this state of molecular rigor mortis, which is terribly important for us because we can take X-ray photographs then corresponding to this wavy state. If these flagella, by bad luck, straightened out through some of the chemistry going wrong, then we shouldn't get what they are, a photograph of what they are like at the moment of transmitting this rhythmic movement. I want to make that point clear. We feel strongly that we have X-ray photographs taken in this frozen molecular rigor, which is an expression of the transmission of a wave of movement along the flagellum or tail. Now, before we leave this picture here, I want to say that quite recently I've been examining and measuring these things very carefully, and we have come to the conclusion, a most staggering, shattering conclusion, I think, when you see the range of which we have been working, that the macro X-ray period, the X-ray macro period along the fibers, these flagella, is also 410 angstrom units, almost identical with what has been established now for several years for skeletal muscles such as the sartorius muscle of the frog. Now, that of course is a terribly thrilling observation, that these things are not merely monomolecular hairs, but more strictly, they are monomolecular muscles. So we're down at the level of single molecules which have the essential properties which are developed to their highest expression in all the wonderful muscles which you study in ordinary histology. But all those are trappings. The essential mechanism must be contained in this tiny thread, which is a single molecule. It is a big molecule, of course, and I forgot to say that when these flagella are compared, say, with tobacco mosaic virus in the electron microscope, because tobacco mosaic virus is a very nice object of calibration. It is known from X-ray analysis that the thickness of the rods of tobacco mosaic virus is almost exactly 150 angstrom units. And you can see at once in the electron microscope that the flagella are thinner than tobacco mosaic virus, and we estimate their thickness to be about 120 angstrom units. We are definitely dealing with macromolecules, and more than that, we are dealing with monomolecular muscles because the period along these molecules is the same as that is in skeletal muscle. But these molecules are not by any means ordinary ones, you see. They have the power of transmitting movement along them, along this single molecule. And by a molecule, I mean a molecule in the chemical sense. I don't mean a single polypeptide chain. It's very doubtful whether any protein consists only of a single polypeptide chain. Even the simplest ones probably contain at least two. But in the more complicated ones, where the molecular weight goes into millions, of course, we are dealing with complexes containing many polypeptide chains. So don't misunderstand me when I say monomolecular muscles. I mean monomolecular in the sense of the physical chemist. So that is the smallest unit which will do the job and has the same weight, the same thickness, the same properties, same everything you like. And it consists of more than one polypeptide chain because it's 120 angstrom units thick. Now, I shall come to that point later. Now, this then is a composite picture of all our X-ray photographs. And I want really next to show you one particular X-ray photograph out of a lot of them, which I prepared with the help of my colleague Dr. Rudolph to show the supercontraction effect. Next, please. See, this has been specially prepared by Rudolph. He took a strip of epidermin, oriented epidermin, that is the protein prepared from the epidermis, and he partially supercontracted it. Normal epidermin would be dominated by the alpha arc there, 5.1, the lower one, but if it is partially supercontracted, then it's partially alpha and partially supercontracted, and as I've told you, never mind about the exact detailed interpretation of supercontraction, we know it as an experimental fact that when we do get supercontraction, we also find that beta, that cross beta arc of 4.65 just above it. Now just compare that, can you move that along just a little bit? Compare that with this picture of flagella of B. subtilis. These are taken specially the same size just to make this point, and you see the terrible similarity that they are. Both of them showing that there are two configurations present in the flagella, the alpha one and supercontracted. Now that is the basic fact, that in the flagella, in this state of molecular rigor mortis, they have just been killed dead at the moment of transmitting this movement, there are two chain configurations, one shorter than the other. Now this is the basic fact which we want to explain this beautiful spiral movement. Side by side, there are alpha chains with supercontracted chains which are shorter. Now we only need one other main experimental fact to come down to the general story of our flagella work, and like muscles, of course, only on the molecular level. Now one other fact, a basic fact, the next one, please. This is an electron micrograph by friends of mine in Holland, Dr. Howink and Miss Van Edison at Delft. This is a very beautiful electron micrograph of Proteus in which the cytoplasm has been retracted here, drawn away, and you can see that the flagella are not merely extensions of the cell wall. Preston and I Leeds showed long ago that the rhizoids, say, of Valonia, the alga Valonia which floats in warm seas around here and clings to rocks, those rhizoids are extensions of the cross-fibrillar structure of the cell wall. But this is not like that. These flagella do come from the interior, and from pictures like that and a lot of other ones which I haven't time to discuss, it is certainly quite definite now that each flagellum comes from the interior, from the cytoplasm, and starts out with a little knob, you see lots of them here, called the basal granule, and that is also well known for the algal flagella. They come from the interior and also start out from a knob. And you get the impression at once then that this knob, of course, is not a little knob to prevent them slipping out. Don't think it's so simple as that. It isn't like that. But it is a kind of a chemical workshop or signal box which sends out some supply, some rhythmic signal or supply of energy whereby some rhythmic movement is transmitted along this single molecule. Because I must emphasize again that Weibull showed that as much as 95% or more of these flagella consisted of a single protein. We have, actually, I say, this animal is swimming with a molecule for a tail, and the energy must be supplied in some rhythmic manner, not, almost certainly not from the outside in the fluid, and the natural conclusion is that this is the source of energy here, this basic granule, and there is a rhythmic chain reaction which brings it about. Now then we come to the very simplest manifestation or simplest idea of how these flagella can work. The next, please. We boil it down out to very simplest terms. There is, say, the body of the animal here. And they're representing diagrammatically a flagellum coming out, starting from the basal granule, which we are assuming is the signal box or source, rhythmic source of chemical energy. Let's assume this thing consists of the simplest possible thing we can imagine. Alpha chains, polypeptide chains in the alpha configuration. One down there and one coming up here. And let's assume that something happens whereby the supercontracted state is initiated in these chains and spreads along, travels along that side. Then suddenly the flagellum will bend to this side. And if it goes back, this wave of contraction, that is a transformation from the alpha to the supercontracted state, goes back over there, then it'll suddenly bend to the other side. Now that is a very simple dodge, of course, which is known in bimetallic strips. But I say this must be the basic idea, because the fundamental facts you observe are two configurations, one shorter than the other. The wave is travelling along and it dies like that and is photographed, and the idea that there is a rhythmic source of energy which transmits this wave reaction. Now I've got a model to illustrate that here. Can I see have the light, please? You may think this perhaps too simple, but there are people who have find great difficulty in believing that we have a reaction started here, it can produce something over there. And I'm not saying anyone in the audience is like that, but I like to show this model. It is rather nice. And it is probably the simplest way of expressing how these flagella work. We have here simply two strips in parallel. One is simply a straight strip of polyvinyl chloride, actually. And on the other side, we have this zigzag strip, two strips, a zigzag, which we call, in England at least, call a lazy tongs, probably are the same name. This, when you squeeze it, it goes out. This lazy tongs on one side and a flexible but straight strip on the other side. Now, if I squeeze just this lazy tongs at this end, it'll get longer and will bend over. If I open it out, it'll get shorter. These zigzags, of course, imitate the folds of the polypeptide chain. And my hand and thumb corresponds to the basal granule where the work is done. I do the work only here, but as I do that, then this thing wobbles about like that, you see. Simply by having two configurations, one of which I shorten rhythmically with respect to the other one. Now that is how a flagellum works in its simplest form. There is the folded polypeptide chain and there is the longer one. And the work is done only in my fingers. Now, I want to elaborate that, because that is only the very, very simplest expression of how it works. And we know now that the movement is not just a waggling, though the more you watch these things, the more you can see they can do all sorts of funny movements. I was watching the other day in my lab polytoma, an alga with two flagella, doing a kind of very beautiful breaststroke. It was just resting and doing a breaststroke as a little relaxation, I suppose, and then it swam off at a great speed, which it seemed to be doing a spiral. But almost certainly the movement along these things when they're doing their ordinary orthodox stuff is a spiral movement like that, not a waggling movement. Though I don't say they can't do the waggling movement, they can. But the evidence is that these flagella, at the moment of being knocked off their bodies in this molecular rigo, are in a spiral form. And one of the nicest pieces of evidence of that is work done by Weibull, who, as I told you, can precipitate these tails with half-saturated ammonium sulfate. And if you examine the precipitate of the tails, you find that it isn't just a hodgepodge at all, but it consists of very beautiful spiral aggregates like the one I'll show next. Next, please. This is one of Weibull's photomicrographs of precipitated flagella. They've been prepared and re-precipitated by half-saturated ammonium sulfate of B. subtilis. And you can't see single flagella, of course, their thickness of 120 angstrom units is well below the limit of resolution. But they aggregate together in this very beautiful spiral form, And I could talk to you a lot about this, of the relation of this to genetics and crossing over and the spiral forms of chromosomes. There's some very close relation. But here we have a kind of a spiral crystallization of this flagella, and what Weibull observed, that these spirals are all left-handed spirals, and they have a period or pitch characteristic of the animal. The pitch of the spirals of Proteus is about 2 microns, and of B. subtilis is about 2.5. We don't really understand this at all, because the gap between 2 microns and the period of 410 angstrom units, which I told you, is too great yet to be bridged. But it is a very wonderful fact that these animals have a pitch of their own. We haven't examined many of them, of course, but you see there's a great difference between 2 and 2.5. It's beyond experimental error, and they're always left-handed. Now, at this point, I always like to, in self-defense, I always like to say that though Weibull observed that these spirals are always left-handed, and this is a very simple model of the movements, there is simply no relation between the color of this model and the fact that spirals are left-handed. I say that in self-defense, of course, only in self-defense. Well, we can look now at these spirals at the electron microscope level. We're trying now to track down the basis of the movement. The next, please. Here is a very, what a thing we're terribly proud of in our lab. You'd think that is a lock of maiden's hair. And it is a lock of molecules. It's a lock of flagella hanging down in their beautiful spirals. They're flattened out a bit, as you see. But symbolically, that is just perfect for a lecture of this kind, because I say I've been trying to tell you that the whole story covers all the way from hairs and muscles and flagella. And we could have, and that could be very easily mistaken for a lock of hair, and it would be a pardonable error, because though it is a lock of molecules, in fact a lock of bacterial flagella, the master plan is the same for both, and there is no essential difference in the idea which governs their long-range elasticity. Now, you can see these sort of spirals arrangement better still in electron microscope. The next, please. This is the Proteus in its younger form, when it has a fewer flagella behaving themselves. And you can see quite well, though these spirals are flattened, of course, in the electron microscope on the grid, on the film, there is one which you can see for yourself as a period of 2 microns. And you can, the more you look at these things, the more you can see that there is a spiral of a characteristic pitch. Now we've got to explain then, in terms of our little model, our little wobbly model here, the lights please now, we've got to get down really to the real problem. This is all right, and this is the basis of it. There's no doubt that the basis of the movement is the transmission of a wave of shortening or supercontraction along one set of polypeptide chains, which bends the organ to one side, and then bends it to the other side, this sort of business. But that's only the simplest way of looking at it. Now, I want you to look at this thing in a transverse picture. Now this is the really exciting part. In case you're dropping asleep, I beg you, don't drop asleep now, because this is the best part that's coming now. Now this is a bit of electrical engineering or mechanics. We've got these single molecules, and we've got to find out how they screw through the water. And they do screw. They don't move in the sense bodily. It's just a wave that goes along like that, continuously coming out of the body of the animal, exactly like a corkscrew when you're having a quick one, a scotch and a seal. Exactly the same movement. Well, let's look at this simple diagram I had of just two, this one here. Look at this now in a transverse manner. There are two chains, or two types of chains, one of which is being shortened, and that one on that side, and and this side, and so on. Now, that we express that like, just like that. And that is alpha, and that becomes supercontracted, then this becomes supercontracted, that becomes alpha. In other words, from the signal box, the basal granule, some energetic rhythm, of which we don't We can't even begin to guess how it works. All this is, it lies in the future. First they become alpha, and then they become alpha, and they become alpha, and they become alpha, and then the thing wobbles up and down like that. That's the fit that what we understand. Now, but you've got to explain a spiral movement, and we ought to be able to do this by means of the working out the X-ray photographs. Now, the X-ray photograph I've shown you is a fearful and wonderful thing which we have not yet succeeded in working out in detail, except to show that the period is the same as that of skeletal muscle, and that it is both alpha and supercontracted simultaneously. But we haven't been able to work out any more, but I say if we were clever enough, or if I were clever enough, which I'm not, to work out this thing, and it's an extremely complicated problem, we ought to be able to find out the arrangement of the polypeptide chains, because let me repeat, it's 120 angstrom units, this molecule, and consists of a lot of polypeptide chains. Just like the tobacco mosaic virus is 40, weighs 40 million, and contains a lot of polypeptide chains and nucleic acid besides. Now, we should be able to work out the position of these polypeptide chains, which would give us a mechanical or electrical system which could be used to form this corkscrew movement. But we can't do that, and what I'm going to talk about now is to deduce from other methods, from other arguments, what the interior of the bacterial flagella would be if we could only work out the X-ray photographs. Now, the first step is that if we can use this double system by activating that and then that, 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 and making it do like that, obviously, if we take a ring of these things, if we take a ring of them and activate them in order, one, two, like that, going around, a wave of shortening going along there, 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 then obviously, then this will just do a spiral movement. That is, you think about that, that is what you do when you transmit a wave along a wave of twisting. It is a wave of twisting, it isn't really movement in the butt. The end of the flagellum is not going around in a circle, the end stays still. It's a wave of a spiral path goes round the outside of the cylinder and twists it round like that. Now, if that is done by a set of chains arranged like a commutator, you can see at once how it should work. Now, can we prove that such a, or demonstrate with any plausibility that such a system exists? I say we can't show it by X-rays or any means inside a bacterial flagellum, but fortunately, recent developments show that this sort of thing does hold in larger flagella and cilia and the tails of algae and spermatozoa. Now, I'm going to show you my latest thoughts on the structure of flagella as a whole, including the bacterial flagella and the geometry of their mechanism and how they work. It's a few things I worked out only a week or so before I came from England, and I thought, whether it's true or not, I'd like to pour it out on you to see what you think about it when you go home. Don't write to me about it, but just think about it. Now, it is most striking that recent more intensive studies of larger flagella, such as of algae and cilia, and especially the tails of spermatozoa, show that these larger algae do disintegrate or can be disintegrated into subfibrils. And one of the earliest pictures of this, earliest it seems a long time ago, it was taken by Jacobson Hall, perhaps 6 years ago or seven, that is very old in the history of the electron microscope. The next slide, please. You see, this is a photograph which I found in a reprint sent to me by Jacobson Hall from MIT, and that is a cilium of paramecium. And these things, no need for me to tell you, they disintegrate very quickly, these very minute organs. That is disintegrating into 12 fibrils. No, 11 subfibrils. This is the cilium here, and on very little treatment, you can see it breaks up into 11 subfibrils. Now, that is one of the earliest things, but recently, people have been observing all over the world, and quite a lot of people have written to me, showing that this sort of disintegration into 11 subfibrils is common over a great range of structures that you'd not suspect. For instance, here is a photograph taken by my colleague Mr. Millard of polytoma, that is an alga, polytoma that has two flagella, and they disintegrate very, very rapidly. Look at this next one, please. See, there are two pictures there on the same slide, but you see them disintegrating. They, I say, they go very quickly on the grid in the electromagnetic scope. But here is a very beautiful one. That, a few minutes before, was a cucumber-shaped flagellum, which very quickly disintegrates into 11 subfibrils. Now, there's been some confusion here because two of those fibrils are much more ephemeral and much more evanescent than the other nine, and it was thought for some time that there were nine in these various flagella. But people kept on reporting nine, then some people said that they'd seen 11, and now it's clear, it's becoming more and more clear that there are really 11. And I say the beautiful thing is that this dodge, this 11 subfibrils, is not merely a property of algae or sperm tails, but over a lot of things. It is obviously a very universal, high-class dodge of nature to produce this spiral movement, because they all do these spiral movements. And there is, I say, polytoma. But let me say this again, that we thought originally, or people thought, there were only nine, because two of them seem to be ephemeral and evanescent. They are rather different. They seem to be more of the nature, as Hodge pointed out, more of the nature of nerve fibers than the other nine. Now the next, please. See, this is some photographs recently taken by Mr. Millard in my lab of cod sperm. We're actually making quite an intensive attack on the structure of the tails of the sperm of codfish, and here's some electron micrographs. There is one quite... it's not quite in... Where's the head? Can you move it a bit? There's the head here. It doesn't matter. It's just off the... Oh, it's there, you see. But that is pretty fresh. But these, you see, these other sperm of cod, these are the heads and those are the tails, are already beginning to disintegrate. And again, remember what I showed you before was polytoma, a green alga. And the other before that was paramecium, the psyllium. Now, next one, please. Here is one of our pictures. You see, you can see, and if you count these things very carefully, you see that the total result is 11, of which two are often lost very quickly, and people think there are nine. Now, that doesn't tell us how they are arranged in space, but there have been very great advances in sectioning in the electron microscope recently, and some very delightful photographs have been taken, such as the next one. Look, that is an absolutely shattering photograph, appeared recently in Biochemica and Biophysica Acta. That is a terribly thin section of the sperm tails in the germinal epithelium of a rat. And you can see that they are surrounded, these tails are surrounded in this case by a capsule or a cylindrical surrounding. But what I want you to see is there are these 11 fibrils are seen to consist of nine on the outside and two on the inside. But I say you might not believe it straight away, but you have to look at a lot of these pictures, which are distorted by the cutting and the drying and that sort of thing. But it seems quite definite that the 11 consists really of nine on the outside and two in the inside. Let me stop to say what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to infer what will be the inside of a bacterial flagellum if we could only resolve them by arguments from what is now being found for flagella of larger size, which perform essentially the same kind of movements as the bacterial flagellum. The next, please. Here is the next one, a very nice one that Hodge lent me on his way back from MIT. He was traveling back from MIT to Australia. He called in our lab and lent me this picture. This is rather a slightly oblique section of the cilia on the gills of the clam Venus mercenaria. Here is the thin end of the cilia, and these are the thick end. But you see, in the normal, in the intermediate part, if you examine that very carefully, you can leave, there's no doubt that the idea is 11, which consists of nine on the outside and two in the inside. The two in the inside being rather different in some way. Now, that is the thing we want to talk about now. I'm going to inflict a little bit of geometry on you now, if you don't mind, because this is the key of my argument, which I was thinking about just before I came away from England. Now, let's have the light now. Here is a worthwhile problem. I think if I may have a cigarette for this last part, I could talk much more intelligently. Here is this wonderful problem now. There is a great device here used in nature for waggling rhythmically the tails of all these wonderful swimming animals. You know, there are millions of kinds of protozoa and sperm which swim about by this movement. And I've tried to show you that essentially the plan is the same as that used in the elasticity of hair and the wonderful movements of muscle. But it is concentrating now in a single molecule which has the power of doing a left-handed spiral. And we are asking ourselves now, how can it come about? Well, I say, it is becoming clear that the dodge used by nature consists of some commutator mechanism whereby there are 9 subunits, subpivots on the outside, and 2 on the inside. Now this is the Almighty's dodge to do this wonderful trick, and does it, I say, in a perfectly general manner in flagella of all sorts of sizes. And we really must get this out. We just can't sleep with a problem like that facing us, because you see, it is not only biochemistry, it is electrical engineering, mechanics, and all sorts of things, and hydrodynamics. Well, we've got to the stage now of having our commutator with 9, and there were 2 more in the middle. Now, how the devil does that work? That's what we want to know. I just want to tell you my thoughts about this thing, just before I left England, whether they're true or not. I think they are essentially true, but I want to pour them out on you, because one of the great joys of science is to pour out your ideas on the other chap and hold him tight while he listens to what you've got to say. He won't always listen, of course, but I've got you people here, and I want to make you listen to this last bit, which is the exciting part. Now, let's look at this geometry. Now, we'll do a spot of trigonometry, if you don't mind. That's the great fun of molecular biology. It involves chemistry, physics, biochemistry, mathematics, and as I've shown you here, hydrodynamics and electrical engineering. Now, if you don't mind, we'll just do a spot of trigonometry, which pleased me a great deal. Next, please. Now, we'll ask ourselves, what the devil are these 9 doing on the outside and 2 on the inside? It must be a geometrical reason, because it is common to all these different kinds of cilia and flagella. Now there, let's put 2 of them up like that. I hope you can see this. This is not very difficult, but it is the essence of the argument. Yes. Now, let's put 2 of them up there on the outside. There's a ring on the outside with 2, like that, and we put another one touching them on the inside, which, say, is one of the inner ones. Now, since we've put 2 on the inside, let's take the circle, which can be described about the bottom of this one, our centre. Let's take this, the centre, and describe a circle on which we're going to put these 9. Let's see if the geometry is right, because after all, it can't be just fun that the 9 on the outside and 2 in the inside. There must be a mathematical reason, because this structure that I'm telling you about, to me, is an abomination, because I'm essentially a crystallographer dealing with close packing, and it isn't close packing. It isn't hexagonal close packing at all, and we want to know why. Well, let's do this bit of trigonometry. It's not terribly difficult if we do that. That is R, say the radius of the thing. This bit is R, that is R. Now, well, I told you, by training I'm an X-ray crystallographer. And one of the great plans in crystals, of course, is hexagonal and cubic close packing. And crystals and molecules in crystals do packing, close packing, if possible, if they can possibly do it. And the hexagonal close packing arrangement is this one here. You see, this is the structure of the honeycomb of the bee, or the giant's causeway in Scotland, and all those things. They are hexagonal close packing. And this is the thing that you would expect, in which there are 10 put together. Now, this is the thing that I like, and there's no vacuum there. The things fit together perfectly. Now, why in heaven, or the opposite place, are there 9 outside there and 2 there, which we've proved by geometry is just a fit? Except for a few minutes. There seems to be a gap here. That seems nonsense. I abhor a vacuum, and long before I was born, of course, nature abhorred a vacuum, as you read in all the books. And what is that hole doing there? It doesn't make sense crystallographically, but it is there for a reason, because without that hole, apparently, we can't work this commutator. What we want to do is to have an impulse which goes round and round the outside there, then it'll do this spiral waggling. That's the point. Now, the answer, of course, if those of you who read your Sherlock Holmes know, remember the great saying of Sherlock Holmes, when you've limited everything else, that what you have left, even though it seems impossible, must be the truth. In other words, by this Sherlock Holmes argument, you come to the conclusion that isn't really a hole at all. It's only a figment of the imagination. That by sectioning, you seem to have a hole there and one there. But let's assume, really, that these pair here, these 2, which are slightly different, the ephemeral ones, are of the nature of nerves, are really spiralling round each other slowly, and when we take a section, of course, they'll seem to touch that and the opposite one. But as we go along, let's assume that either they're standing still and these are spiralling slowly around them, or they are standing still and these are spiralling, it doesn't matter, the same thing geometrically. And then, these two then, as we go along the flagellum, will touch first one, then the other, and then the other, and they'll go on like that. And then if we imagine an impulse going along these two, these nerve-like ones, then we can have an activation passing rapidly around this commutator. And if we assume then that, by a process which we don't know, gives rise to supercontraction in part of the polypeptide chain, then the thing will start to wobble in this beautiful spiral manner. Now that's the thing I want to bring to tell you about, because I was terribly thrilled about this, and that is the argument that that is how it must work essentially, and not only in one kind of flagellum, but in all of them that we have been examined so far. And if we could only now resolve the bacterial flagella, which we can't, they're too small, we should find polypeptide chains arranged like that. I hope I've got that right. Now, we want the commutator systems I've shown you here. Let's assume now that this is not a hole, that the paradox between this and that, of course it is a paradox because this is what you would like, this is what nature does in crystals, is not a real one, that this is not really a hole, but these pair are twisted around each other slowly so that they are touching first one, then the other, and an impulse goes along them which activates all these things like that, and then we get this wonderful thing. Now, I've tried to make this lecture as a study in an adventure in molecular biology, and it is for general purposes for a medical audience. Not only medical, I've shown its mathematics, physics, biochemistry, electrical engineering, hydrodynamics, and the problem of life, of course, is like that. And I've been very happy in my scientific career. Because I started off as a physicist, and then a textile physicist, and after that, before textile physicist, an X-ray analyst with the geometry of crystals. But I finally came to apply all this training which I'd had to the problems of molecular biology. And you do get the most fun. I'm sorry to say it, that those of you who are professional biologists that didn't start off with chemistry and physics are really to be sympathized with, because you don't get the real fun, you tend to get blasé. If you start off with chemistry and physics and mathematics first, and see what these things are doing down at the molecular level, and then of course your eyes pop out of your head. In fact, I'm continually pushing my eyes back ever since I started this business of studying the molecular tricks of nature. And year after year, I've not done any biology at school or the university, and some people say there's no difficulty in recognizing that. But I've had a lot of fun, which I'd like to bring to your attention, that when you do get down, not merely to the picture of striations in somebody's textbook of histology, but how a muscle works as a little machine, and especially how these flagella work, which are the molecular manifestation of muscles, and when you come to these beautiful problems like that, then things are very, very happy indeed. And I've had this sensation so many times, and I was going home, it was only about a week before I sailed, with this little drawing, this geometry in my pocket, and I was feeling very, very amazed as usual. I'm always terribly thrilled at what I find when you get down to the molecular level in biology. And I want to finish up with a little story which is quite accidental but is very, very profound, I think. You know that the London Times, our Times, is quite turned inside out from your papers. We have the advertisements on the outside and the meaty stuff on the inside. Whereas you have the meaty stuff, you can read your papers by looking over a man's shoulder. You needn't buy the paper. Well, you can't do that with the Times, you've got to open it. But on a very famous column on the front page of the Times is the personal column, or more commonly known as the agony column, which of those of you who know your Sherlock Holmes, he read this always. He didn't read anything else, but he always read the agony column, or personal column of the Times. And I read that too. I'm getting too old to expect secret messages, but I think perhaps someday there will be a secret message there, and so I read it. But the first at the top of the agony column, for many years now, there's been a quotation from the Bible. Now, you no need to tell me that some of the most wonderful prose in the English language is in the Bible, and someone, I suppose the staff of the Times, have chosen day after day some apt quotation dealing with, generally with world events, or national events at least, and generally very wonderful quotations. Now, I look at these, and some of them you can see are very, very striking. But believe it or not, when I went home, I don't read the Times in the morning because I get up so late I can't do anything in the morning, but late at night I find time to read the Times, and I start off by reading the personal column. And lo and behold, it's hard to believe, I picked up the Times on that day when I was simply full of admiration and wonder at this beautiful commutator trick for producing the spiral movement. And there at the top was a quotation from Isaiah. Nothing is too hard for me, saith the Lord.